right. Hello there, everybody. Welcome to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I'm Adam A. Donaldson, and I am the host of this fair program. But joining me today this week is...
I'm Candace LaPage.
And Candace, did you hear about this guy in Kitchener that almost got Donnie Darko'd?
No. My goodness. Really? There was plane... This whole thing about plane stuff dropping from the sky is really getting terrifying.
It didn't turn out to be a plane. It turned out to be like a piece of like a tree shredder or something related to the cutting down of trees. Because he lives near Chicopee, where they're doing some like rearranging of the property, and so they're cutting down some trees and planting some trees elsewhere. But apparently, this thing broke, went flying, and came crashing through this guy's bathroom roof while he was brushing.
Wow!
Barely missed him.
Yikes.
It was almost a Donnie Darko level event.
Or a Dead Like Me level event.
Ooh, yes, quite right. I didn't really watch that show, but...
It was a good one, but it all starts by George getting killed by a toilet falling from the sky.
You know, I knew that, but I also knew that because in I have like a box of swag I got from like comic cons and stuff. And from one con one year, they're giving away like these foam toilet seats to promote Dead Like Me. Mm. So that's a glimpse into what goes on here at Snake Mountain. But there you go. End Credits is a local movie show for local movie fans. We're here every Wednesday at 3 p.m. to talk the latest in pop culture and review the newest movies, which this week will be the new horror romantic comedy Lisa Frankenstein, which you can now stream on premium VOD. You might have missed it when it was released in theaters back in February. It was the same, I believe it was the same weekend as Argylle, that Argylle came out, which you can now stream on Apple TV Plus if you are so willing. But I did note a piece on IGN about Lisa Frankenstein where the person said everyone went to see Argylle so they could go dump on it on social media.
Yeah, I was gonna say, I don't think everyone went to go see Argylle because that wasn't very well liked either. So
no, but certainly more people saw Argylle than Lisa Frankenstein, and I think we will both argue later in the show that that was something of a movie crime. Maybe a misdemeanor movie crime, not necessarily a felony movie crime. but first, a movie nobody missed that came out in 2004 was a movie called Shaun of the Dead. It was released 20 years ago this past week, at least in the UK. It did not come out until the fall of that year here in North America. It was a September release. This sometimes happens with movies that are made in other jurisdictions. They are released in those countries, and then they find distribution in North America, U.S. and Canada, and they come out here. And that's what happened with Shaun of the Dead. For people who may not remember, it is a movie from Edgar Wright, from a script that was written by Simon Pegg and Edgar Wright. This was kind of the movie that launched both of them. The first movie in what has been dubbed the Cornetto trilogy. So you get Shaun of the Dead, Hot Fuzz, and The World's End. It also launched Simon Pegg to be the face of sidekicks and blockbusters. Mission Impossible and Star Trek come to mind, but he's been a very busy beaver since this was released. Edgar Wright too, and maybe we'll talk a bit about Edgar Wright's career since Shaun of the Dead a bit later. But focusing on the movie right now, Candace, revisiting Shaun of the Dead 20 years later, what are some of your thoughts?
Yeah, so I did not see this one at the theater. I know. It can't have been later than the fall of 2004 because I became very busy opening my own restaurant store in January of 2005. So I definitely was not sitting at home watching rented movies after that point. So this might not have lasted in the theater very long and gone pretty quickly to rental because I rented it. And I remember vividly watching it. It was after my roommate had gone to bed. And I just, I laughed so much. At one point, my roommate actually came out of the room, not to complain about my laughing, just to, you know, come out of the room and get herself a glass of water. Mm-hmm. And she stopped and asked me, said, "What on earth are you watching? Because you are laughing so much right now." And I told her, and she was like, I don't think that that would be very funny for me. Because she's not really, you know, a horror fan. She's not really into zom-coms, as we call them. But yeah, like I was blown away by this film when I saw it. And it's on, you know, sort of a short list of perfect films to me.
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure I'd call it perfect. I think it's very, very good. I think it's probably even... I think that what's remarkable, we're watching it again this past weekend, was how good it stands up after the sort of like glut of zombie stuff that's come out since, and not just like straight up zombie movies in terms of like straight horror, but you know, there was a wrath of like zombie parodies after this, like Fido and A Little Bit Zombie, Zombieland, Juan of the Dead, which not terribly dissimilar, except it's somebody who is Mexican, I believe. So you know, it is kind of remarkable that you're able to look back at this and still like really kind of gel with it, and gel with its sincerity, which is weird considering it's a comedy. Like, but there's a real sincere understanding and love and appreciation for the genre, and especially the way Romero does it. Mm-hmm. Because like some of the kills in it are very sort of explicitly inspired by that the original Dawn of the Dead, especially one of our main characters later in the film, and I think you can imagine which one I'm talking about.
Yep.
Trying to not be spoilery, but for a 20-year-old movie, but it's but you know, I saw, oh, I can't believe I'm going to talk about this. I saw an article on Screen Rant, and it said, like, it wasn't called 10 Things That Are Wrong with Shaun of the Dead Today, but that was kind of the gist. And yeah, one of the things was like, it's too, like, it doesn't know what to do with its tone. It's like, is it a comedy? Is it a serious zombie movie? And it's like, why are you an idiot? Because it's...
I hate that argument.
Well, I mean, it also just doesn't make any sense to me, because I think one of the things I really enjoy about it then and now is that it is taking the idea very, very seriously. It's not like one of those like date movie or scary movie things where we're just like, nothing is serious, nothing is real. There are jokes in it. It is funny, but the people living in that movie are living in something that looks like reality. And they're taking the concept seriously. The whole thing where they're like saying, don't say the Z word, don't say the Z word, is part of that. Because as soon as you say zombie, you kind of undermine the seriousness of the situation. And it's hard to have that comedy. I think the comedy hits harder because it's taking the situation so seriously.
Yeah, yeah. To me, this very much feels like a zombie movie that happens to have comedy in it. Mm-hmm. Like, and not only that, I would say all of those people who are like, oh, we don't know if it's supposed to be funny or whatever, they should go back and watch some of those old zombie films. Like, Zack Snyder's Dawn of the Dead isn't funny, but George Romero's Dawn of the Dead does have comedy in it. Not only that, I would also tell them that they should go watch, I think it's a Fulci film, the Zombie, which...
Yes.
Yeah, Zombie and Zombie 2 and Zombie 3, which is the weirdest sort of thing, because zombie, there's no real zombie movie. It's like starts with Zombie 2, but in some places called, it's very confusing. But those movies,
it's a very Rambo situation.
Yeah, very ridiculous movies. And and like the campiness of it, it's like zombie movies were campy. They were campy.
Yeah.
So this actually doesn't, it's not a campy movie. It's actually, as you say, like they take the fear of it, the zombie of it, very seriously, but all of the characters happen to just be very funny and I mean, in funny circumstances.
I mean, you go back and look at Night of the Living Dead, like a lot of that beginning is like really camp, like the way he's Barbara's boyfriend at the beginning, the way he's
brother.
kind of like,
it's her brother.
Is it her brother? Yeah, you're right. You know, they're visiting their mother's grave, and you know, the zombies lumbering through, and he's like making fun of her. They're coming to get you, which is
a line that was ripped and given to yeah,
completely reversed. And I picked up on it this time, and I was like, oh yeah, good one, Edgar Wright and Simon Penn.
Yeah. Peg. Whereas I laughed immensely the very first time I saw it, because Night of the Living Dead was the movie that essentially kind of made me want to be into movies. Mm. I watched it when I was about 10, and the copy that I got was called George A. Romero's Night of the Living Dead. So mm-hmm. that was like the first time that I realized, oh, there's actually like a person who directs these and who makes decisions about them and who does all these things. And that's what really started me wanting to be more involved in movie making. So that's a movie I know
it's
pretty darn
ultimate,
well.
Yeah, it's the ultimate independent movie in many ways. But yeah, to getting back to that beginning part where she's like being, you know, the brother gets killed. She's, spoiler alert, is running from the zombies, and she heads to the abandoned house, and that's where she runs into Dwayne Barry. And as soon as he steps in, it becomes like the siege movie where he's calling the shots and coming up with the plans, and they're, you know, resolving each crisis. But when like Barbara's running from the zombie, like that is, there's something like kind of silly about it, like these lumbering things, like you haven't really got a sense of their power as a force, because you haven't really seen them gather en masse yet. So yeah, it is, there is a piece of this where you kind of have to accept in the beginning, this is kind of ludicrous. And it's by accepting that at the beginning, you're able to really buy into the horror and the terror and the, I guess, the claustrophobia later of like being surrounded by people who only mean you ill, who you can't negotiate with, who you can't, you know, reason with. Mm-hmm. And
not only that, not to make this a Night of the Living Dead commentary rather than Shaun of the Dead, Barbara's character is absolutely useless from that point forward. And
yeah, she's catatonic,
you know, between catatonic and screaming.
Yeah.
And it's very funny. And like, even they're taking it very seriously in the movie, but you know, she gets slapped at one point, like, you know, trying to like get her to calm down. Mm-hmm. And that is funny. And I believe that was probably funny to the audience at the time also. Like now we watch it funny because it just seems so like, what is up with this woman? It seems so out of time. But I believe that at the time, that was also, people were like, whoa, she's going a little wild here. Tone it down.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. And you know, there's definitely although there is a Barbara in the group in Shaun of the Dead, the Barbara isn't the Barbara. David's kind of the Barbara, where he's kind of the one who's kind of always hysterical and insisting that they've taken a wrong turn or they've done the wrong thing, as if there's like a playbook in this situation that to follow. Thinking about, because having just lived through a global pandemic, it's not like I've never watched a zombie movie since the pandemic, but I find this true for a lot of movies that are about, like, where like the effects of a virus or something are kind of at the core, where you see like scenes where, you know, something bad is coming and you see people coughing in the background or being
just
sick,
passing out at the bus stop.
But I mean, there's so much of this in this movie where a lot of it's going on in the background, where it's like, you know, you see somebody wandering, lumbering, and it's really written into the beginning of the film where you know, you see this people going about their lives, pushing shopping carts, ringing people through the till, walking around. When Sean wakes up and he lumbers out and he's, you know, yawning, and it's typically just evoking sort of like typical zombie iconography, I guess is how you want to put it. And it makes it what I find interesting, it really sets up this thing where you're looking in the margins and you're looking in the background. It's like, what's weird? What's different? You know, there's a scene where he goes into the Winchester after Liz breaks up with him, and you see the couple making out in the corner, and then him and Ed come out after a last call, and the woman is eating the guy. It's, you know, and the reversal of things, and a real testament of like how much you could ignore a crisis as it's unfolding. And then at the end too, where they have not only lived through the crisis but have adapted the crisis to suit like back in the normal lives. And I'm just like, I'm thinking about that too, where, you know, we've domesticated the zombies now. You know, you used to feel like a zombie pushing the shopping carts and bringing them back in the store. Now we have actual zombies doing it, and they're good at repetitive tasks. And here's a zombie game show, and
Yeah, it's a, you know, a much more noble version of automating all of those jobs that nobody wants right now. But so, like every good zombie movie, this movie does make sort of, you know, political statements, right, about the quality of our lives as we live them to begin with, right? And as I've just mentioned, the you know, sure, we'll automate these jobs nobody wants, but it's okay because there's, you know, there's still people. It's not a robot. It's fine. But also, you know, in a way, the fact that, you know, we watch these characters go through it, and they, you know, don't notice it as it's starting. And it kind of, you know, talks about how, like, we all think we're the main character, but we're only the main character of our own lives. Like, a whole lot of other life is going on around us that we don't know anything about. And all of these, like, zombie movies where we always end up somehow at the, like, army outpost where people are, you know, working away on things and know what they're doing. It's like there are a lot of other people that are never ever going to make it this far in the, you know, story of the zombie outbreak. Like,
You really hit onto something though, and sorry for interrupting, but I think that is like the core source of a lot of gruntlement coming out of the pandemic, is that a lot of people thought when the S storm comes, they would understand what they needed to do and how they were going to go about it, and the whole survivalist pastiche was going to kick in, and you know, you were going to be in your bunker and you were going to be locked and loaded. And like, that's not what happened. It was, you know, a thing where you had to just like take a few precautions, keep your social distance, wear a mask, get a vaccine when they're available, and life goes on.
Yeah, none of us are that important to the world, but we are important to the people we care about. You know, what do? They go save Sean's mother and Sean's girlfriend.
And incidentally, her roommates.
Yes.
But you know, you mentioned like we're all like the main characters in our lives. There's such an element to that, because you have like people like Elon Musk, who, you know, seems to fundamentally think he's the main character in this simulation of life, and most of the rest of us are NPCs, just here to like work around him. There's a real kind of reality to that, and I think one of the things this movie's really good at is, you know, ain't none of us expendable. A lot, and a lot of the movie too is about Sean, this guy who's never really had, he's managed to coast. He keeps making promises about making changes that, you know, whether it's quitting smoking or taking his girlfriend somewhere that isn't the local pub. And just, you know, he's confronted with like, no, you have to change. You have to rise to the occasion. You have to be adept. Bad things are going to happen to you, and you'll have to adapt. And I do wonder how much of that sort of translates to, you know, everyday people, or even not necessarily everyday people, but like the people like Musk's, who like think that they're like the masters of their own little universe, and because this very the movie is very much saying like, you don't get to control much. You get to control you, and how you kind of like are able to, you know, work within a system is kind of entirely up to you. And you know, it your world is much smaller than you think it is.
Yeah, I mean, really, they even sort of show that in the film, right? When they bump into his friend Yvonne,
right,
beautifully played by the actress who acted against him in Spaced.
Yep.
But like, there's literally like, you know, what, at five or six of them, like it's the same thing, and there's a whole other group doing the exact same thing. They happen to sort of wander towards each other. They don't decide to team up or anything. It's just like, okay, great, carry on. You know, that's our lives. We're all just carrying on trying to survive on our own, which is actually also the line that they say both times that they meet, like, you know, how's it going? Well, surviving. Okay, great. Like that's all we're trying to do in this life, is survive with the people that matter to us.
Right. And it's
perfect movie.
Yeah. You may be getting there. You may be convincing me, but I think, you know, looking at the overall kind of zombie climate, and we talked about this, it was like the really, you know, you get within 6 months of each other, you get that Zack Snyder remake of Dawn of the Dead, which is like super serious, like big money, like loud, bright, shiny Hollywood remake of something that was, I think, probably had like $1 million more than Night of the Living Dead when Romero made it. I mean, it was certainly high budget by Romero standards, not necessarily high budget by Zack Snyder in the year 2004 standards. But so you get these two movies. It's 2 years after 28 Days Later, which kind of gets the ball rolling. Next year, you get Romero coming back to zombies with Land of the Dead. And you know, now we're on our way. You get to today, where it feels, I mean, even though they're still cranking out Walking Dead shows like it's Christmas morning, it feels like the genre is played out. Like George Romero like starts getting played out of this too, like Survival of the Land of the Dead, I think, really kind of slaps, but Survival of the Dead, Diary of the Dead just feel tired by comparison. Like by the time The Walking Dead, the original recipe of Walking Dead, ended, it felt tired.
I didn't even make it through all the seasons of The Walking Dead. I was just like, after season three, I was like, I get it. The humans are the problem. I don't need, you know, five more seasons of this and three more spinoffs.
Right. And I think in Shaun of the Dead, and maybe because it comes early in this sort of zombie blitzkrieg that we lived through much of the first part of the 21st century, that there is something, I don't want to say life-affirming. Well, maybe I'll say life-affirming. It doesn't necessarily, you know, one of the things that really drove me crazy about The Walking Dead was just how it, as you said, it kind of languishes in this morass of like pessimism and never-ending cycle of torment and, you know, one bad guy after another who's just wallowing in the, like, I mean, the world's bad enough. Do we need to really constantly crank out, like, you think this guy's bad? No. Down the road is an even worse guy.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, I worry that is what will happen to humanity when we're called to a small group. But I really want to hope that there are going to be people who want to rebuild and be hopeful and help each other. That's what I want to see.
Yeah.
But I worry it's going to be the other way. So I don't need to watch it in my entertainment.
No, for sure. And I think that's, there is a promise. I mean, yeah, there's kind of like a crass, you know, aspect of like using zombies to collect shopping carts at the end of this. But there also is something relatively like, there has been a change. There has been a small change. Like the apartment is clean now. Him and Liz are living together. So there's this such kind of like domestic tranquility. Sean seems to have risen to the occasion. He showed leadership in this crisis. They've got Nick or Ed, Nick Frost's character, Ed. You know, chained up, zombie Ed chained up in the shed, which, another thing I clued into, like, they had never been in the shed until now, until they went in there for like weapons. Really prioritizing the garden work there. But, you know, there is this feeling like things, at least for this character or these characters are going to, I mean, maybe not Ed, but are going to be better going forward, which is something that a romantic comedy does, not necessarily something that a horror movie, especially a zombie movie, does.
Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, like I said, I think we can do it. Somehow, at least one episode of The Last of Us did manage to do this. You know, the episode 3, the love story between Nick Offerman and gosh, I can't remember the actor's name, but you know, while it was also heartbreaking, I think they showed like, yeah, you know what? We can actually rebuild and we can let a few people in and we can like love and live after some sort of horrible thing has happened.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I want to see.
Yeah, no, for sure. I think there's an understandable concern that the human instinct goes towards despicableness and
yeah. Power, just wanting power, because power means security and safety, and so that's what.
Yeah, no, for sure. I want to talk a little bit about before we wrap up. Here is the career of Edgar Wright, because after this, he goes and does the second part of the Cornetto trilogy, which is Hot Fuzz, which I think is the superior film. Mm-hmm. I think. Yeah, okay, good.
I don't at all. Oh, Hot Fuzz is my least favorite Edgar Wright film of all time. I don't enjoy it. I know other people really love it. I saw it and I was like, no, I don't. I can't. I couldn't get on board with any of the conspiracy of everything. It just didn't work for me. And I know everybody else loves it. So maybe I'll try it again. I think I've watched it a couple of times, and I mean, I do love Timothy Dalton. He does play a delicious bad guy.
Oh, he's great as a bad guy in it. He's great.
I believed the weird alien things taking over everybody in the World's End more than I could believe in a small town having a whole town of them all in the conspiracy. There was just something I couldn't.
That's interesting.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know why.
Because I like The World's End, but I also feel like it's kind of like the tag on. It's like, well, we did the first two, we got to do the last one, because he's already like he follows Hot Fuzz with Scott Pilgrim versus the World, which is a completely different flavor of things. And it's so funny watching that movie because. I mean, yeah, Michael Cera's a star, and he's kind of, I mean, he's still around, but he's in Barbie naturally, but
a billion other stars in that movie.
I know it feels like you get Alison Pill, you get Mary Elizabeth Winstead, you know, Brie Larson. I would say like even Brandon Routh,
yep.
Kind of Chris took Evans. After this, Chris Evans. Yes. Chris Evans.
Jason Schwartzman. I just rewatched this about a month ago. So
yeah. Is it Rory Culkin or is it Kieran?
I think it's Kieran Culkin.
Kieran, right?
Oh, maybe it is Rory. I don't know. I can't tell those Culkin kids apart.
Hold on, hold on. I got. It is Culkin.
I think it's Kieran. Kieran, I think it's the one who's in that show now.
Succession,
Succession, yes.
Yes, yeah. He succeeded with Succession. Aubrey Plaza's in it, too. And Anna Kendrick. Oh.
Yeah, everybody. Oh. Everybody is in this movie. It's a lot of people.
And Bill Hader is the voice? Yeah, okay. and we get a Don McKellar cameo, which I love, too. Thomas Jane is Vegan Police. I forgot.
But then following that, I mean, Baby Driver.
Yeah.
I absolutely adored that film. I think we might have covered it for the show.
Yeah.
But I adored it. Unfortunately, two of the actors in it have soured some of that experience. And so I haven't rewatched it because I just am not sure how I'm going to feel about it. But Jamie Foxx is so good. In that, and John Hamm, it was great. Baby Driver was amazing. I was so, impressed by it. And then I watched Last Night in Soho for the first time, just last year, towards the end of the year. And I'm so sorry that I missed it in theaters, because it was just beautiful. And that's something that is actually present even as early as Shaun of the Dead. Like, that was Edgar Wright's first movie. He was mostly filming TV, but you can tell, like, with Shaun of the Dead, there's actually a couple of scenes where you can see him literally saying, I started on a TV. Here's the TV ratio. And then he just pushes in until it becomes full screen. And so this happens every time Shaun is at Liz's apartment and we see him through the sort of window of the door. It always starts in 4:3, and then we just keep pushing in until, you know, so we're holding on his face and pushing in until it becomes full widescreen. But he's always known how to compose a shot.
Yeah. There are a lot of tracking shots too that are like, when he's going to the shop, especially the one after, like the morning after, like his stuff has started to go down, where it's not just you're following Shaun as he's going about his routine, like you're watching like the action and the destruction of the community, going past bodies and, you know, and stuff. Yeah, like there's real filmmaking talent in this that I think gets overlooked, as it does with a lot of comedies. Frankly, people don't really talk a lot about the filmmaking prowess of a comedy, but you can definitely see that there is someone talent, which is another reason why I think Hot Fuzz takes it up a notch, because that's action. Like, so it's pure action, and it's like a lot of that action is like really cinematic too. In so much as like Shaun of the Dead leans into the seriousness of a zombie movie, Hot Fuzz leans into the seriousness of, like, we're a cheesy 90s action movie.
Yeah.
with like quick cuts and zoom ins and maybe we'll have to have a Hot Fuzz revisit at some point too.
I suppose I could.
All right, we're going to take a quick break and come back and talk about Lisa Frankenstein. Speaking of horror comedies and romance in them, you are listening to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus, and Community Radio.
Are guys so simple that you just have to put on a pirate skeezer dress and suddenly they want to talk to you?
Oh. Well, thanks, I guess. How will I ever repay you?
Well, I can't just get you new parts. I mean, you're a dead man. I'm not a Chrysler LeBaron. Oh, I want to help you. I really do, but I don't know how. Besides, Taffy says it's a waste of time to try and fix a boy. It's better just accept a guy's flaws.
Okay, so that was a clip from Lisa Frankenstein. It is the new film from Zelda Williams, and it stars Catherine Newton, Cole Sprouse, Liza Sobarano, Henry Eikenberry, Joe Crest, and Carla Gugino. And although it is from director Zelda Williams, who is whose daughter?
Robin Williams' daughter.
Yes, it is from a script by Diablo Cody. And I found reference that apparently she acknowledged that this takes place in the same universe as Jennifer's Body.
Yeah, I heard that too, but I don't see any.
I don't think that matters.
How could we? It's like a decade and a half away from each other.
Yeah, but it does have a kind of spiritual connection, I think, with Jennifer's Body, which is a movie that has gotten its reappraisal, understandably. Although, you know, I remember seeing Jennifer's Body at TIFF. I guess it was 2009 it came out. And the audience loved it. Like, there were big whoops and claps and, like, standing ovations at the end of that. And then it comes out, and I feel like that's when people lost the thread. I don't know if it was because people had overdosed on Diablo Cody because of Juno and everything, or if people were sick of Megan Fox because of the Transformers and everything. But I also think the marketing did that movie kind of dirty, because I see a lot of like really strong connections between Jennifer's Body and what Diablo Cody has presented as a script in Lisa Frankenstein.
Yeah, I mean, I can definitely see what's going on here. And I think part of this is this movie, Lisa Frankenstein, actually is quite not quite different, but it's a lot more Heathers and a lot less like Warm Bodies.
Yes, I
And
agree.
I think because it's called Lisa Frankenstein, and so people think about Lisa Frank, which honestly, I didn't know anything about Lisa Frank until, the most recent 10 years, something on the end, like people going crazy about Lisa Frank. I'm like, did it just happen just slightly after me? Or is this a States versus Canada thing? I don't know, because I didn't know anything about Lisa Frank. But I think because it's obviously Lisa Frank, people were expecting a little more joyful comedy part. Which this I mean, it's a style of joyful. Do you find it joyful to watch people murder together? Those who murder together stay together? I don't know.
I mean, it's kind of like a joyful of idea of death, and I sort of picked it up right away. You sort of see it in the opening credits, a very kind of like Tim Burton, like we're goth in 1980s California. It's sunny all the time, but we don't care for it. We would much rather talk about zombie movies and George Malaise and wear
Yeah.
black and
It's funny because I loved those opening credits, and I've heard a lot of people talk about the Tim Burton-ness of it, and I'm like, I didn't feel that at all. Like, to me, it felt a lot more old-fashioned, like more sort of like silent movie era. And I think like I got a lot of Heathers from this, and the only time I was getting Tim Burton was actually in the parts that I liked the least.
It's interesting. I mean, I think one of the Tim Burton's influences are like, because this is the sort of feel, it's Tim Burton-y, but it's also kind of reminded me of like 60s sitcoms like The Addams Family and The Munsters, where it's very much like we're mixing the macabre with the everyday, and you live next to monsters, and they're essentially just the weird neighbors. You don't really think too hard about living next door to a vampire or a Frankenstein's monster. And I feel like that's kind of what it's channeling here. This just like we're fed up with how bland and normal and sunny everything is. Like, let's just be weird and let's go hang out in a cemetery and fall in love with the dreamy bust of this like musician who died 100 years ago. It's all good because mom was murdered by an axe maniac, which is I thought was going to play a role in the movie beyond just like why is Lisa so weird, but hey, I guess your mom just gets randomly murdered by a masked man with an axe sometimes.
It doesn't seem like that was any part of the reason why she was so weird. And what's funny is that I don't actually think she was so weird. I think she only
No.
became so weird after does he have a name, the monster? No, it's just the
He's just
creature.
a no,
Okay.
he's just called the creature in it, yeah.
So I don't think she became so weird until after he showed up. I think before he showed up, she was just, a fairly typical teenage girl in the 80s who, as she says, like the cure, it's for music like us, people who have feelings. Like, I think that's just it. She was just a person who had feelings. Like, she actually seemed pretty well adjusted in general, but also particularly about her mother, which, maybe is part of her weirdness. But I don't know. I didn't find her to be that weird.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's I mean, I certainly know people who I don't want to say hang out in cemeteries, but that's kind of weird. But you know, I certainly know people who find them, you know, interesting. And
yeah, you're talking to one. I have hung out in cemeteries.
Okay, fair.
Made a pot of tea, got in a blanket, and gone and sat in a cemetery. Yeah,
you know, but yeah, it's not so much that she's weird. It's so much as because you know this is. It takes place in 1989, and so there's this very clear, like, who you're supposed to be. Like, you're supposed to be, like, Janet, the stepmom, who's, like, into aerobics and walking around the house in jazzercise gear and, you know, being positive. It's like, yeah, your mom was, you know, killed by an axe man, but, like, why, like, you know, why are you, you know, obsessed with these macabre things? Why are you going to the cemetery? Like, why aren't you, you know, going out on a date on Saturday night? It's very much like,
yeah,
it's very much like a prescription. Like, there's one way you're supposed to act as a teenage girl, and that's like Taffy. You're supposed to be a cheerleader. You're supposed to be positive, life affirming, not really interested in like books and stuff unless they're assigned by a teacher. Not like writing poetry for the literary mag, because that's weird. But so, I mean, weird is very much in the eye of the beholder.
Yeah. Yeah. Though, speaking of Carla Gugino, I loved her character. And I think it is so funny. And you were sort of talking about how, you know, you're supposed to be like her, right? Like the mother who's doing aerobics and eating her like grapefruit and cottage cheese diet salad and all that sort of stuff. But what's hilarious is how she is not well-adjusted. Like, this is, to me, Lisa is the well-adjusted one, because she is the one who is not well-adjusted. And she actually says it, because she says to Lisa, you know, like, she was being coddled because of her mother. Said, nobody ever coddled me after my father was blown up in Da Nang. Yes. And then you get a look on her face. Carla Gino, she's so great. Like, that look on her face. And I was like, okay, there we go. See, that's what happens when you don't feel your feelings.
That's such a great line. No one coddled me when my father blew up in Da Nang. And it's like,
just like, that is brilliant. I love it.
I think they maybe should have.
Yeah, that might have fixed some things.
Yeah. And you know, the dad is so distant. I was trying to look up, I was trying to think of like where I knew
Stranger Things from.
I guess so, but I never watched Stranger Things beyond season two. And
well, because I don't think he was on it past season two, so he was the father in the first I mean, the father period. But yeah, it's only in the first season that we really see Finn Wolfhard's character. So the brother, sister, so their parents, one of them is Joe Crest and the other one. And so they completely have like no idea what's going on with their kids the whole time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's obviously what's going on here. And I can't decide if casting him in that, like, a lot of people have talked about casting him in that. They're like, what? Is this the only thing he can do? Is he stereotyped? And I'm like, no, I think that this is actually part of the joke. Like, I think it wasn't just that they were like, oh, we need a character who can do that. It was like, oh no, let's actually get the guy.
You might be right, because I think he just slips so effortlessly into this part of this, like, you know, vaguely, you know, distant, disinterested dad. Like, you know, it's weird that he, you know, I think it's like a year or a bit after the mother has died, he's remarried Janet. And it's just,
yeah, he could probably stand to feel some of his feelings too, I think.
Yeah, because it just seems like, oh, it's something I got to do. I got to get remarried. I got to rebuild the family unit. And then, you know, that leaves Taffy, this actress, Liza Soberano, who I was unfamiliar with. But, you know, here we have someone who's playing against type, because she should be the mean girl stepsister, and she's not. She's actually a fairly, fairly loving and someone who's trying to, you know, her advice is not always great, but, you know, you clearly get a sense that she is looking out for Lisa and that she loves Lisa and wants them to be sisters. And there's something very generally life affirming in that relationship.
The Taffy character was great, because we are introduced to Taffy and Lisa once they're getting ready to go to a party. And it's very clear, like, these two girls have nothing in common. And I will say the one thing that I thought, because they did sort of say, like, you're my sister, but I sort of thought, because obviously they're not sisters, like, there's no way, but I sort of thought, oh, maybe this is actually set in college, which did make me feel like, I wish we would just set these things in college. These actors are so not high school students. And when people are in college, they're still going through the same things. They're still teenagers. They're still, like, experiencing things for the first time. Let's just start setting them in college. But yeah, the two of them, like, were so different. And she seemed so kind of flighty and not listening to Lisa that it was like, oh, okay, great. We know what this is. This is, like, the evil stepmother, the sort of evil stepsister. Okay. And then it was totally not that at all. And I think she was probably one of the best characters.
Yeah.
Because one, again, she did feel her feelings, even though she seemed kind of superficial when things actually really
get out of control.
Happened to her. Yeah. When she was faced with trauma, she actually had fairly normal reactions to them and, you know, continues to, like, not to give away the end, but at the end we do see her and you can see that she has processed some of what's going on. The dad clearly hasn't.
Yeah.
But I think that she's like, it's okay, I can still, you know, be that person. But also recognize that some really major life things happened to me and I'm going to feel certain ways about it, and that's okay.
It's, yeah, it's funny there at the end where you clearly see a change in Taffy and the dad is like, well, this is what happens, I guess.
Yep, you still have cheerleading though, right?
On to the next episode. What do we think of Catherine Newton?
I love her. So the first time I remember seeing her, as it turns out, it wasn't the first time I've seen her, but the first time that I remember seeing her in a thing and knowing her name and going, oh, this actress is in Freaky.
Yeah.
And she was so great in Freaky because, of course, she has to play Vince Vaughn, essentially.
Yeah, tough call.
In many of the scenes. Yep. And so I, you know, my very first time seeing her, I was like, whoa, she's really, this is quite a stretch here going on. So I was pretty excited to hear that she was going to be in this because I thought she could really do something interesting with it. And I think, I don't know. I feel like she did, but I also feel like it was pretty safe, maybe.
I think a lot of the acting was in the eyeliner at times.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, the way it accentuates her eyes when she lowers the shades and looks over the top of her sunglasses. Yeah, she's interesting. I feel like she was really game for this. And I mean, a lot of that is reflected in Freaky too. You know, she seems to be like a real I'll try anything kind of actress, which, you know, power to her. But yeah, I'm not sure. And this may be at the heart of the Lisa character too. A lot of this I find goes back to Diabla Cody, because I think she had a sense that maybe coming off of Jennifer's Body, a lot of the criticism was about her and not about the people who were very critical of Jennifer's Body. And so she tries to pare that down a bit. Like, you do get some of the Diablo Cody-isms in this, but not so much. I feel like the script is trying to restrain itself to it. And Zelda Williams, I think she's an interesting director. I think she's got talent. But I think Karen Kusama really kind of understood the assignment a bit more in terms of, like, because, you know, you watch Jennifer's Body and if you're reading it, the script, you can see the jokiness of the writing with some of those Diablo Cody-isms. But when you watch the movie, it is played 100% straight. Nobody is playing it for laughs. That is like a darkly serious, like, teen horror that has funny stuff in it. But I think that watching this, I think Diablo Cody's kind of restraining herself. I think Zelda Williams isn't 100% sure she knows she's hitting the right tone. And I think that is kind of reflected in what Catherine Newton's doing as well.
Yeah, and I feel like, so I do really like this movie.
I like it too, yeah.
I like it a lot, yeah. And I'm going to rate it very highly. But I also think that I maybe went in with too high of expectations. Mm. Because, you know, it's funny, like we're talking, like I'm talking about how it's, you know, Catherine Newton is a little bit safe, and you're talking about how, you know, it didn't really want to go into the horror, and like this feels like more of a satire than a horror movie that has comedy.
Yeah.
But meanwhile, we are talking about a movie where someone's penis is axed off and then it's sewn to another person's body.
This movie goes hard for necrophilia. I agree.
Like there are some things that happen in this that is like, what? And it's interesting because I had to, because my weekend has been so busy, I actually had to watch this movie in two parts. Mm. And so it started and I was interested. I was liking it. Cole Sprouse suddenly came on board and I was not liking it as much. I really had some issue with how Cole Sprouse was acting as the creature.
Yeah, he's a little modern. He's a little modern.
Well, it's just like, why is Cole Sprouse playing Johnny Depp?
Yeah, there's
and
that.
Not only that, like they even with the makeup, because they've clearly got him in prosthetics for more of the earlier part, because as he continues to get electrocuted, he gets sort of more and more alive. Mm-hmm. And so changes are made, but to me, like they've definitely put prosthetics in his cheekbones. And I'm just looking at it going, I feel like you just took a Johnny Depp face mask and put it on Cole Sprouse. Like, why? Like, we are like really leaning into this, and I don't understand why. And I wasn't a fan of how he was acting the role.
Yeah.
And so I was starting to get a little like, okay, I'm not enjoying this as much as I wanted to, but then it started getting really good again. And then unfortunately I had to pause it right as Lisa catches Taffy with the guy. And so I had to pause it there. And I was like really into it at that point. And that's a really hard point to come back to cold, because that is like a pretty, there's a lot that happens in that scene, and I think you have to be there, like you have to have gotten there, you can't just come back cold to that. And so I really I want to watch it again all the way through, because I feel like I will take the love I had for sort of the like 35 minutes right prior to that and carry it through. I will say, when I completely fell in love with this movie was the REO Speedwagon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's some good needle drops. I agree with you about Cole. He didn't quite bring it either. And again, I'm not sure that's something in the script or in the direction or what was going on. What I did appreciate is just like there is a real firm love and understanding of Frankenstein, like both the book and the James Whale movie in this. Mm-hmm. That I appreciated. It could have been a bit more gothic instead of just goth, but I mean, that's that may be a personal quibble, but I think you're right. I think this movie has more going for it than it has going against it. And I do think Zelda Williams has considerable talents. I think the cast involved has considerable talents, and certainly you don't see a movie like this too often. That is just sort of like, even if it isn't like really going for it, it is going for something, which is more than you can say for the Argyles of the world.
Yeah. I do really want to say one thing though about Zelda Williams.
Sure.
So Zelda Williams, as previously mentioned, is the daughter of Robin Williams. Mm-hmm. And so, of course, with that comes a lot of, one, expectation, but also just a lot of, like, warm feelings and nostalgia and love for, you know, for Robin Williams.
Yeah.
And one thing that I absolutely loved that I noticed, and then I recently watched some Gen Z YouTubers reviewing this movie so that I could see, like, you know, because I feel like it's definitely made for a Gen Z crowd that also I can appreciate.
Sure.
But one of them, I laughed a lot because one of them said right at the very end, we see the creature, Cole Sprouse, and he's wearing rainbow suspenders, which is what Mork and Mindy wore all the time, right? So I'm like, that's Robin Williams. And someone said, she goes, why is he wearing pride suspenders? And I was like, oh my gosh, people don't know Robin Williams. Like, it's so wild.
He's been dead 10 years.
I know, but what I really want from Zelda Williams is that I want her to put one thing about her dad into every movie she makes. Just like, just put it in there. And it's just for us who know.
Mm-hmm.
No, and the Gen Z crowd can think that they're pride suspenders if they want. But the rest of us know.
The rest of us know. We'll leave it on pride suspenders. That's it for this week's show. We hope you liked it. If you want to listen to our show again, you can download it every Friday from our website at endcreditsradioshow.com, from the Guelph Politicast channel on Podbean, or through your favorite app like Apple, TuneIn, and Spotify. We're also on Spotify for the music that you hear on this show. Just search for End Credits on CFRU to find that playlist. And stay connected to us on social media. We're on Facebook at End Credits Radio Show, and we're on Twitter at End Credits Radio. I will return to CFRU Thursday at 5 p.m. for the News and Politics show I co-host with Scotty Hertz called Open Sources Guelph. And I'm also on Twitter and Instagram at my name, Adam A. Donaldson, or you can go to my News and Politics site at GuelphPolitico.ca, which just leaves Candace, who's going to tell us where we can find her out there on the internets.
Yes, I am on the internet everywhere at CINN48, that's CINN48, all the social medias except for the horrible one. It's just bad there. Just drop X, drop Twitter, whatever. You should be able to hear a new episode of the Village podcast by The Bookshelf, which I co-host a little bit later this week.
Oh, I will make a note. And stay tuned for more great programming here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. This show End Credits will return next week with a brand new episode, and we will see you then.